Chapter 15 Pebble. Morning came early for Maqua, thanks to a kujanga howling out its whooping cry just before dawn. A new scent filled the air, and as Maqua crept from the tent, he saw what it was. On both sides of Kuli were huge wazah trees that towered high above the Tortanga as he plodded on in the gloom. For all his size, Kuli seemed dwarfed by their sheer stature. The swamp was deep around them, with water coming up almost to the edge of Kuli's shell. Maqua climbed up to sit next to Tuljapa and watched him. The Tortanga sage stared out over the water before them, his eyes seeming to gaze somewhere unseen, and his ears twitched as though hinting at sounds unheard. He blinked a few times and turned to look at Maqua.
"You're up early. How are you this morning?"
Maqua waved a hand in a so-so gesture.
"I'm okay. Can I get you anything to eat or drink?"
Tuljapa nodded with a smile.
"I see why Saru speaks of you with pride. Your manners are very good. My second water skin is in my part of the tent."
The nimble one-time thief nodded and strode back over the length of Kuli's shell to tiptoe his way through the big communal tent, moving over and around sleepers in the gloom as he got to the back. He opened the flap to enter Tuljapa's quarters and looked around. There were many trinkets and small baskets hanging from the ceiling of the room, and the inner walls were painted in odd shapes that were dark against the light of the torches outside. After the curious moment of discovery passed, he searched the floor and found a long, low chest that the sleeping furs were on. Tied to a metal loop on the edge of the chest was a water skin. He untied it and took it with him as he edged backward from the room. He tied back the covering flap and turned to bump right into Shimna. She gave him a dubious look and followed him outside the tent.
"Maqua, what were you doing?"
Her voice was almost too loud to use with sleepers nearby, and her expression was one that looked untrusting with her tail twitching and her ears pinned back. He held up the water skin and blinked, perking his ears as he glanced at it. She blinked back and peered closer at it.
"What do you want with that?"
He snorted as he thought about why she was acting so weird, and his ears went back with a little growl.
"Are you asking because you know I was a thief? Is that it?"
He felt his tail puff up at the notion. He wasn't that person anymore. Of all people, she should know better.
"Aquisin?"
She flicked her tail. Maqua shook his head. The talkie was difficult to use when he was angry. He offered the questions again, this time in her language. She huffed, and her tail went a little limp. But then she crossed her arms and cocked her head at him, ears still back.
"No, I would ask this of anyone I find in that room. I ask because Daddy keeps lots of important things in there, including his medicines and tools. If any were taken, he would be very upset."
Maqua stuck his tongue into his cheek and nodded. He was right, and no matter how she dressed it, it was still an accusation and proof she didn't trust him. It stung. He growled in her general direction and turned his back on her to walk over to the front of Kuli's shell and hand Tuljapa the water skin.
"Shimna thinks I would steal from you. Maybe you should send someone she trusts next time."
Tuljapa blinked.
"She crossed words with you on this."
He nodded and turned to go back into the tent. As he walked back by, he found Shimna, who stood in his path with her ears back and her arms crossed. He huffed in annoyance and went to walk around her. Without a word, she reached out and grabbed his arm, putting her hips into it and yanking him about, jerking her claws free and spinning him to face her.
"Maqua!"
He hissed in shock and looked at his arm where small trickles of blood oozed from the deep little cuts. He held his other hand over the wounds, and by some miracle kept his voice from being a yell.
What's wrong with you?
He hadn't done anything but be insulted, and she was clawing him. Shimna paid neither the injury nor the question any heed, and her whisper bordered on loud.
You try to get me in trouble. How could you do this, Maqua?
She stood there, ears back, tail lashing behind her, eyes furious. Maqua clenched his fists and lashed his tail as he contemplated hitting Shimna or scratching back. He glared at her and peeled back his lips in a low, threatening growl as he took a step closer, leaning near her face.
You little...
Her ears panned sideways with a yip, and she bolted to the front to sit beside her father and, of course, start talking. Maqua huffed out a snort and stomped off to the tent while licking the fresh cuts above his wrist. This was stupid. And the more he thought about it, the dumber it got. Having told Joppa see him hitting Shimna would be one of the quickest ways ever to anger Saruth. It would be real trouble, no matter how gentle the man was, once the story reached him. There was also the fact that Til Joppa might personally beat him senseless for attacking his daughter before bothering to tell his guardian. Even in his anger, he knew that much, and also knew Shimna wouldn't leave it alone. It was impossible for that girl to leave anything alone. He had to get away from this before it got any more idiotic. An escape plan began to form. Cooley came to a stop as the warm rays of the dawn reached out over the world to claim it in their gentle embrace, and the plan became action. When the Tortanga sank down into the water beside a large rock that bordered the beach, Makwa hopped off onto the rock, wearing his armor and pack with his spear in hand. He needed some time alone. There hadn't been much since he'd left Barumith. There were lots of people in the port city, but he could be alone in a crowd of strangers. That was a luxury he missed in the company of people who cared for him and knew who he was. He made his way down to the bank and landed in the sticky mud with a wet sound. In spite of the mud that wanted to stick to his boots, he felt free as he went. Til Joppa saw him go and stopped Shimna from following him. There was an argument between the man and his daughter, but he refused to let her pursue. Makwa didn't pay attention to understand most of what was said, but did catch Til Joppa's comment about a boy needing his space.
Thank you, Til Joppa, he
thought as he went. He walked up the bank into the thick underbrush and used his spear to push the plants out of his way as he explored the rocky island within the swamp. There were many stone surfaces that seemed out of place in the landscape of mud and sand. He made a morning of it, found some kupatha berries for breakfast, and let the part of him that wanted to wander do so. After walking around for a while, he located a small pool that had green minerals in the bottom of it and smelled like copper coin. Sniffing around led him to realize that the warm water was in many pools nearby, and that this island was rather large in comparison to most that were in the swamp. He forged a trail through the underbrush and moved under some fallen logs and over others as he followed his wanderlust. He noticed the terrain beginning to rise, and at one point he came to a small clearing and looked upward through the hole in the brush. He could see that the land was sloping steeper as he went along. There were more kupatha vines, so he ate more berries. At first, the trip seemed slow and plodding, but as Makwa continued on, he got better at pathfinding. He found himself knowing where to step and where to look for the next opening in the brush ahead without having to stop to consider his options as often. He didn't notice it at first, but after a time he realized the air was getting warmer. Earlier he had paid it no mind because he assumed it was the natural warming of the day. Given enough time, he realized it couldn't be just that. He looked up every so often to keep track of where the sun was so he could find his way back. Soon, strange smells surrounded him. Some of the smells were bad, like the smell of rotten eggs, while others were good smells, almost like cooked fish or fire. The sounds of the swamp and the distance around him were peaceful. There were the splashes of fish and the buzzing of insects. At one point, he stopped dead in his tracks, jaw dropping. He saw a small creature that looked like an amphibian of some sort swelling up from the surface of the water, expanding as it ascended. It had little brown and green spots on its wet yellow skin and kept getting fatter and fatter, but for its small head and hips as it rose up, midsection growing, fan-like fins at its sides unfolded. When Makwa managed to close his mouth, it looked at him with bulbous eyes and uttered a soft "Florp." He tilted his head and reached out with his spear to poke in its direction. No sooner had he done this than he saw a small blue spark in its mouth and jumped back as it belched out a burst of flame and zipped backward in the air, deflating as it fell into the water. "Whoa!" He blinked, touching the tip of his spear and feeling the warmth. "Urf." A soft gurgle announced the return of the creature in the other end of the nearest pool, and again it rose while swelling. "Blorp." Eyeing him, it began to release gas from behind its fins with a soft, sputtering hiss and glided away over the water, catching a breeze and drifting out of sight.
"Well," he blinked, "that was different."
He snorted and turned to continue. A little while later, a movement to his left caught his eye, and he paused to look. Something about it made his tail twitch. He saw the gentle sway of trees and other plants in the soft breeze, but nothing else of note. Maybe it had been too long since he'd been alone? He scratched his head as he was distracted by the itching behind his ears. It was more frequent now, and often spread into the back of his head when he scratched.
I hope it's not pelt bugs, he thought to himself.
He'd heard sailors talk about them being a problem in strange lands. He banished the thought and continued up the path. He hadn't taken 3 steps when there was a small sound behind him and to his left. He felt a shiver move from tail to ears, and he whipped his head around to look. The noise sounded like the brush of an animal against a large dry leaf. He gripped his spear in both hands as the soft wind moved the plants in its passing, and his eyes narrowed as he watched them all sway in their slow natural dance. He called out in just over a whisper, "Hello? Shimna?" No answer came. "It's just the wind. I'm not scared, he thought to himself. Somehow, his puffed tail didn't seem to agree with his mind, and he rolled his eyes. He turned to continue and found the underbrush growing thinner as his path grew steeper. Soon, he found himself grasping trees to help him up the slope here and there. This caused him to look up and notice the trees were now more like those one might find in the high forest in Barumith's hills. They were softwoods that grew as tall as a ship's mast, and had leaves that were long and thin. His ears panned back at the sound of dry leaves being displaced, and he glanced down behind him. There was nothing at first, but then a gust of wind made its way around the hill and scattered some needles from the trees to send them falling to the forest floor. His mind was starting to agree with his repuffed tail. He was sure now that he was being followed, or watched, in the very least. It didn't want to risk looking stupid by running from a little girl. He waited and watched with a low growl under his breath as his tail began lashing. The forest plants waved with the gust, but when the wind ceased, they stopped moving, save one. A moment of thought told Makwa that he had seen that plant before, but he wasn't sure where or when. Transfixed, he watched the bulbous yellow top of the thing sway for a moment longer, and then still. He took a step back, and then another, all while watching the plant as he searched his mind for what it was and why he should fear it. He bumped into the tree behind him and felt the strap of his pack tug his shoulder as it pushed to one side and guided him around it. He glanced at the pack and thought, "That's it!" The plant began to travel again, a slow shuffle vague in its dedication to its direction. It seemed smaller because it was downhill from him, but it was as tall as some ships were from the water to the deck, and brought with it no small measure of menace even with its vaguely directed approach. He watched it draw closer. The predatory plant paused, and then turned its head to point more in his direction. The tendrils that gave it mobility bunched at its base with a faint crinkle of dry undergrowth being compressed. It tilted its stalk toward him with a quiet draw of air near its base.
"Oh, great fish!"
He turned and scrambled up the path. Behind him was a shuffle of brush as the Zarmuth gave chase in a short charge that ended with an explosive hiss. As he fled, he yelped when he felt the impact of the beast's thorny tongue smack against his backpack with a loud scrape. Inspired by terror, he crashed some 100 feet through the undergrowth, taking swaths of brush all over his body while clawing his way up the steeper spots with a strength born of feral fear, and almost dropped his spear 3 times. When he noticed that all he heard was himself, he glanced over his shoulder and paused while panting. On the slope below, the plant was milling about without any real direction. He guessed it couldn't see very far, which was good to know. He looked around to make sure there were no others like it nearby, and sat to catch his breath while picking plant bits from his fur. He glanced at the sun and then down at the Zarmuth below, a shudder flowing through him as the adrenaline ran its course. He pulled off his pack and found a sticky smear across the back, complete with a new set of scratches.
"I hope I don't find you on the way back." He glared down at it.
Mako continued uphill, and by what he thought was about the 4th hour of light, he reached the summit. There he found a large rim of rock surrounding a bowl of steaming, bubbling mud. The vapors were blowing away from him, but the whole place stank of what Makwa's imagination assured him must be the breath of evil spirits. The thought made his fur stand on end. He pulled out the pebble that Saruth had spoken to him about at a time that seemed long ago. He looked over it in his palm and sought comfort in it while he stood on the very edge above a lake of mud and filth. Where was his life going? Was he really so different than he had been, given that Shimna didn't trust him? Why did it hurt so much that she didn't if he wasn't? His eyes strayed out over the natural cauldron of muck below, and he sighed. That annoying itch resurfaced behind his ears, and he reached up to scratch it with the hand that held his spear. When he did, his foot slipped from under him, and a moment of sheer panic took him as he jerked back so as not to slip into the dangerous mud below. His other hand went down to cushion the fall while he maintained his grip on the spear behind him. He grunted a yelp as he landed high on his backside, his tail pressed upward at an angle in which it wasn't meant to bend while the weight of his pack smashed down against it.
Ow!
He shifted his hand forward on the ground to push himself back from the edge, and winced, lifting his stinging hand to shake it. He heard a sound a moment after, and leaned to look down at his pebble bouncing down the inside of the bowl toward the mud 10 feet below. Tack, 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 plop. He scooted back from the edge a bit more, groaned as he rubbed the base of his tail, and then stood and looked around as he considered going down to get it. He set his pack well aside, leaned as far down as he could, and used his spear to touch the inner rim of the bowl, which seemed to be rock or packed dirt covered in powdery dust. No good. He set the weapon aside and centered himself on the edge to ease his feet down against the inner rim. Just as he was about to slide down, he thought better of it. He imagined getting stuck in the mud and not having anyone to save him. He could feel the heat from the gooey substance where he perched on his palms, and imagined the joy of dying of thirst as well if he were to get stuck down there. That would be fun. Maybe Sir Ruth would find him in time? How? Also, how long from now would it be if that happened? His ears splayed as he considered all this. It could be hours before Sir Ruth even thought he'd been missing too long, given that Tel'Joppa didn't seem to worry about him wandering off to get some space. Nope, he thought to himself in silence. He flopped forward and dragged himself into a sit, only to turn around and scoop back to the rim and look down once more. He knew he wasn't going down to get the pebble now, because there wasn't really any safe way to both secure it and also his escape. He didn't have a rope, did he? Wait, there was one in his pack. He looked at the bag, almost reached for it, but was arrested by the next thing he considered. He looked around. There was nowhere to attach a rope. So much for that. It was a bittersweet thought. What was it Sir Ruth had said about survival in dangerous situations? Foresight grants hindsight. His own voice startled him a little and his ears laid back. Sir Ruth was right, and it was annoying. He took a deep breath and stared at the blue sky. He stood, put on his pack, grabbed his spear, and scratched his head as he looked down at the pebble with a glare. At least he was still alive and not in more peril brought on by thoughtless stupidity. Sir Ruth would appreciate that as a consolation prize when he admitted to losing the pebble, right? A deep sigh flowed through him as he closed his eyes for a moment and turned to go. His lack of continued carelessness wasn't going to mitigate the fact that the man was going to be disappointed. Sorry, Sir Ruth. 2 steps away, he stopped. He thought. He'd seen something with his eyes closed, but had no clue what it was. He walked back and looked down into the edge of the mud where the pebble had fallen. It hadn't sunk below the surface. He closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and then let it leave his body. There it was again, and this time he knew what he was seeing. With the eye of his mind, he could see the shape of a small crystal where his pebble was. It was like when he chose the crystal for his talkie, only at a much greater distance. He concentrated and looked closer without moving his body to see the crystal hidden within the little pebble. He opened his eyes, and the focus faded until he almost lost it, but then came back as he hummed to himself. He blinked when he realized he was humming, and lost the crystal in a moment of distraction. His ears pressed back against his skull, and he lashed his tail. Oh! He blinked again in disbelief. No way! He closed his eyes and focused hard to find it again, then opened them as he hummed 3 notes in a row over and again, a low note first, then a higher one, then finally a note that was higher still. He worked with it, and felt the crystal in the rock seem to brighten in his mental view as he experimented. A jolt of excitement gripped him as the rock shifted in the mud. It grew louder as he felt the focus get better, and the little rock seemed to shiver about below. He kept this up for another minute or two, noted the movements each time he hummed the 3 notes, and then tried something new. Come to me. As it shifted about, the rock rolled a little closer, moving up the mud an inch or so. Again, Makwa chanted, Come to me. He could see it working, and feel the rock getting closer in his mental view. He came to the sudden realization that looking at the rock with his eyes had nothing to do with it, and that the reason he hadn't succeeded before was because his mind hadn't seen it. When he closed his eyes, he could focus much better, and he chanted in a sing-song voice, Come to me, come to me,
Come, little crystal rock, come to me.
He could see how his mental energy seemed to flow around the crystal and the rock, know its texture, sense its movement, and view it in a way that he found spooky. In the stillness of his mind's eye, he saw the rock as a shining white crystal surrounded by a light blue covering, which he could only assume was the stone hiding the gem within. All around him, as far as he could see while he focused on the pebble, was a haze of deep blue nothing. He could only see the crystal because it had its own light, and the rest of the world seemed to come to an end only a few feet away in the blue darkness. He watched in his mind and kept chanting as he saw the crystal making a slow ascent from the muddy bowl below. Small, swirling tendrils of whitish-blue mist seemed to come from where his mind saw and coax it even higher. After about 10 minutes of this, he could feel the pebble floating before him, but he dared not stop for fear of dropping it. His thinking was slowing because of his intense concentration on keeping the tune right, but he soon formed a plan. Come to me. He ended the song on the high note and opened his eyes as he snatched at the spot where his mind saw the pebble. Thwick! He opened his hand to reveal the pebble in his palm and blinked in disbelief.
Yes! I did it, Saruth! I did it! Now you've got to teach me the next part!
He tipped his head back, threw up both arms holding his spear high, and let out a whoop of elation that he was sure would ring from the top of the world, only to slip again and catch himself in the same way he had before, when his backside had an impromptu meeting with the rim below.
Great fish! Ow!
Tack, 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 plop. Oh, no. He rolled his eyes. This would be a long morning.